things going directly.
Can you hear me without it?
No, you can't. The fate of the Russian Revolution depended on the Commonwealth. Lenin, 1919 statement. Without the German Revolution, we shall surely perish. Again, without the collaboration of the working classes of at least two or three advanced countries, it is impossible to maintain the Soviet regime. Now, he did not, of course, foresee the actual course of development. When he said, we shall surely perish, he thought, working class, eroding, foreign intervention, civil war, ruin of the economy, the whites will win, in one form or another. Perhaps through transition, peasant government, then military dictatorship, and so on. He did not foresee, nobody foresaw, the actual development of Stalinism, but on the central question, absolutely right. The fate of the Russian Revolution depended on the success of the Comintern Party in Europe. And when a gap opens up, the wave, the revolutionary wave of 1919 subsides, or we can say subsides by the summer of 1920, then the question is, how long is the gap? Where do you go? What do you do? Essentially, what they tried to do in this period was hang on. Hang on. And hanging on meant retreating. The whole question of the NEP, which I'll come back to in a moment. Let me, however, first remind us of the dates. Summer of 19, April 1919, foundation of the Communist International. By the time that meeting in the Kremlin took place, Soviet power in Russia was withering, already, no question whatever. Second Congress, real founding Congress, 1920, in effect, the Soviet system, which is described in the manifesto of the First Congress, the actual organization of the exploited classes, their actual administration of affairs, was in the past. The regime was a regime which we can best compare, in general political terms, to the Jacobin dictatorship of 1793. It had a great deal of working class participation. But it was no longer, by the time of the Second World Congress, if we open our eyes to reality, I've quoted that bit from Lenin too. I didn't realise it when I started. If we open our eyes to reality, Soviet power had been replaced, just as the convention was replaced by the Committee of Public Safety, has been replaced by the party. Third World Congress, 1921, by the time the delegates assembled, not the party, as such, but already a bureaucracy ruled Russia. A military, bureaucratic machine. That is the reality. Not a question of the party substituting for the class, as a matter of fact, because the party itself was influenced and profoundly influenced, because it was a mass organization, by the conditions of economic decline, catastrophic shortage, and the war economy, the repeated mobilization again and again and again to stave off the immediate military threat. Before that Congress met, the early 1921, after an immense amount of internal conflict, incidentally, interesting point about that, very bitter, sharp internal conflict about apparently not very central issues. Basically because the leaders did not know where they were going. They could not see the way forward, except in general hang-on terms. Then, April 21, they made up their mind. Not without conflict. We have to make a massive retreat. The whole war economy, which in the euphoria, many Bolshevik party leaders had identified with, you know, the transition to socialism, we've abolished money. It's a fact. During the period of war communism, they'd abolished money. You know why? Well, because money had been totally worthless. Now, as it happens, I've actually seen an economy like that. The pure accident of age, circumstance and place. Germany, in the immediate months after the end of the Second World War, money was absolutely worthless. The real currency was cigarettes, of course, petrol, fires and so on would do. A non-monetary economy. But that was not the advance to socialism. It was a result of catastrophic industrial devastation. And similarly, with war communism. All the nonsense which is contained, for example, in Bukharin and Freya Brzezinski's ABC of Communism, which someone in debate last night said, this splendid textbook of the Bolshevik Party, actually, it is theoretically largely rubbish. And the central question, come on, if you're wrong on the central question, it doesn't matter that what you have to say about the relationship between art and social life is brilliant. I mean, it's meant to be a political work. The NEP, massive retreat, meant what? It meant this. In fact, we have to bank on the regeneration of the forces of petty capitalism. Capitalism. We have to bank on the peasantry. Therefore, ending of forced requisitions of grain, which is the way the cities have been fed. Reintroduction of a stable currency. Monetarism, comrades. Much more savage monetarism, as a matter of fact, than Thatcher has ever ventured. Because they actually said, we've got to go back to a gold standard. The only way in which the currency can be stabilised is the tying of the ruble to the actual amount of gold we've got in the bank vault. Savage deflation. Again, return capitalist methods, classic capitalist deflationary methods, tended to restore the value of the currency, and then they hoped, relationship with the peasantry. The peasantry has now got the land, you will get the development of agriculture, you will get an increase in output here. As a result of that, there will be a certain stimulation first of secondary industry and then of primary industry. You will have a revival. And, of course, if you go on for long like that, then the regime will become historically obsolete, won't it? Because the social relations of production are basically capitalist, the regime will go. One way or another, the regime will go. They were right, they didn't foresee the way it would go. But, and this was the expectation, but if there can be, if the working class can take and hold power in major developed economy, all this need not happen. Although we will be backward and so on, tied to Germany or whatever, yes, it's still possible. That's the justification, and the only possible justification for continuing to hold power. I've dealt with that at some length for this simple reason. Well, the rest of the talk talks a vast amount about Stalinism. It is important to realise that the dilemmas go a lot further back. That workers' power did not exist in Russia by the time the NEP was introduced. Workers' power did not exist in Russia. 1921, the Third World Congress, all the arguments about the United Front. The dilemmas, not due to the mistakes of this or that leader, although of course they made out some mistakes, were inherent in the situation, in the impossibility of socialism in one economically backward and economically ruined country. How great its potential wealth? Socialism because of the impossibility of workers' power. So now let us look at the other side of the equation. The fate of the Russian Revolution depended on the Comintern parties. But the fate of the Comintern depended on the outcome of the Russian Revolution. Now, here again, it is important not to read back later events. This is commonly done by various, well, by Stalin, of course, who will have a line of continuity from the beginning to the end, but also by the vast majority of bourgeois commentators and scholars, including the serious ones, I mean the ones who've got some intellectual integrity. Most of the writers on it, the Shapiros and so on, are intellectually rubbish. But there are serious, you know, bourgeois scholars, people like Carr. For E.H. Carr, basically, the pattern was determined from the beginning. You know, the Comintern was a writer. That's completely wrong. The crucial year, the decisive year, given what had happened to 1920 up to 1921, the decisive year was the year 1923. Now, it is not true. In 1923, although Stalin had been General Secretary of the Bolshevik Party for, what, 2.5 years, although the reaction was getting underway in Russia, it is not true that the Comintern had been reduced to an instrument of Russian foreign policy, nor was it true that whatever the Russians said, after a little argument, is carried. It wasn't true as early as that. It required, the thing was on a knife edge, and it could go either way. Now, in 1923, there was a revolutionary situation in Germany. I'm not going to talk about that. Christopher Harmon is going to talk about it tomorrow. I'll talk about the German Revolution from 1919 on, I imagine. But it is also, and comrades, I do urge comrades to go to that. It's very illuminating, not just from the point of view we're talking about now. The fact of the matter is that, however you look at the mechanism, the German October failed. That was a massive defeat in terms of the German Communist Party and the German working class movement. But it was not, for Germany itself, the decisive defeat. What came out of the German October, too, the Communist Party was outlawed for 6 months, 8 months or something. What actually came out was not a right-wing regime resting on the state machine, the police, the middle classes and so on. No, 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 in spite of the defeat, the German working class was still too strong. The bourgeoisie needed the Social Democrats, needed the trade union bureaucracies, and therefore all sorts of possibilities opening up for the future. Now that's not in any way to mitigate the catastrophic consequences in many ways of the defeat. Harmon will talk all about that, but it's important for us to realise the German working class was not actually smashed. Although its organisations were weakened, they were still relatively intact, and possibilities for revival, for growth, not only existed but actually occurred. 1923 was decisive, not for Germany, but for Russia. Because 2 years of the NEP, the regime was on its last legs. Already in 1921, Lenin, towards the end of the year, Lenin, who was already sick, nevertheless could see the essential problem, wrote a speech. He was not well enough to be able to deliver it. He wrote it. It was delivered for him. In which he said, and it reads like a speech, he says, "We control the state, but can it be said that the state has operated the NEP in the way we want it? No, it cannot be said. It is as if we are driving a vehicle, but the vehicle does not respond to the driver at the wheel, but to some mysterious, lawless hand. We steer in one direction, but the vehicle goes in a quite different direction." Now, approaching the problem, very profound remark. What is this mysterious, lawless hand? Actually, the social forces, reaction, the thermidor, generated by the decay of the working class. By 1921, the working class was down to 1 million. And that figure, the mere statistic, doesn't tell you the half of it. The reality is that 1 million were demoralised and so on. That bureaucratic substitutionalism, inevitable, right, in the circumstances of the Civil War, but nevertheless it long continued developing a momentum of its own, and again, the development of the Kulaks, because the NEP in its early period was successful in terms of the objectives they set themselves. Trading grain did flourish. There was a differentiation amongst the peasantry. You know, rich is a relative term. When they talk about rich peasants, most of them strike you as pretty miserable by our standards, even the richest of them. But yes, a layer of peasants employing labour, small farmers employing labour, have come, not as early as 23, to dominate, but to supply a very large, to control a large part of the marketable grain, the grain over and above peasant consumption. Why talk about grain? We wouldn't do that in Britain, would we? Remember, this is an overwhelmingly agrarian economy. And the basic problem, you know, is not, my God, our technological techniques are lagging behind Germans. It was, how the hell do you feed the population in the cities? Not how do you give them a rich and varied diet, but how you actually fill bellies. Right? In these circumstances, therefore, these reactionary forces exerting a profound influence through the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy, in turn, exerting a profound influence on its party component, which the bureaucracy at the top consisted largely of party members. Oh, series of measures were employed to attempt to counteract this. There was the party maxim. No party member, they had accepted, the NEP, you've got to accept inequality of payments, and you've got to pay very highly for bourgeois specialists. These damn surgeons are all emigrating. Because they can get much more money. You've got to pay them more than the Germans pay them, actually, because the conditions are worse. You've got to have enormous equality in terms of remuneration. Similarly with the apparatus. But if the administered and so on. But if you're a party member, right, you get the salary check, but you are not allowed to keep more of it than 2,000 rubles per month. What they reckon was the average monthly wage of a skilled worker, right? So that informal, no economic privilege, formally anyway, for the leaders. Or these many similar mechanisms, but these mechanisms, this is, you know, the limits of voluntarism. You can do a number of things by act of will, but if the social forces are profoundly against you, in reality, it's like a dam which is terribly leaky, and you're rushing around plugging up this hole, plugging up the other hole, and so on, but such is the pressure of the water on the other side that for every thing you plug up, two new streams come running through. Now, that was true at the beginning of 1923, but the forces of reaction have not got a conscious political expression. Now, this is worth thinking about. You know, we all know ABC Marxism, at least I hope we do. You know, politics is about class struggle, classes, parties represent class interests, etc., etc., etc. And that's all true, but that's the ABC. And as soon as we go D, E, F, it's more complicated than that. Parties don't spring, or political organisations don't spring automatically into existence because there is a social need for them. Actually, they have to find a way in terms of what has happened before, in terms of the accidents of personnel, in terms of specific political and social features. They had not. 1922 even, most of 1923, the reaction, the Russian Servidor, had not actually found a political expression. The bureaucracy at the top was still schizophrenic, including Stalin's. They were still committed to the notion the central thing is the European Revolution. Absolutely no question about it. There is a lovely statement which I've never read before until I read Harman's book. He'd extracted it, you see, he'd been through all the German publications, from one Joseph Stalin, no less, in the summer of, late in the summer of 1923, saying, "The German Revolution will be the most important event of the 20th century, incomparably more important than our own." Right, even Stalin, therefore, who was to become the embodiment of the reaction, the bureaucracy at the top was still clinging to that. Once it had been clear, become clear that this was a nonsense, you know, it wasn't going to happen, we'd been defeated, sensational transformation. Again, in terms of the how it's done, how it actually happens, it's messy. Arguments, left opposition comes into existence. Arguments about administration, about bureaucratisation, about palliatives, how we remedy the situation. That's what basically the whole, you know, the initial period of the left opposition was about. Putting himself in opposition to this, Stalin was able, the other way around, being pushed into opposition to this. You know, the relationship between the leader and the supporters is a complex one. Stalin instantly rallied around himself all the reactionary forces, and the reactionary force is immensely powerful because the working class is effectively impotent. The theoretical expression of this is, of course, the doctrine of socialism in one country. The one country that they were concerned with, of course, was miserable, ruined, backward, ignorant, uncultured Russia. Right? I mean, it's not worth having the theoretical argument about Germany or what have you. What matters about socialism in one country is when the argument was put forward and why. Because what socialism in one country was this. It was the declaration of independence of the bureaucracy, of independence from the workers' movement. The workers' movement in Russia no longer existed. But until the defeat of the German Revolution, the workers' movement in the sense of the Comintern, a revolutionary workers' movement, did exist, and they regarded themselves as relating to that. After 1924, no. So, up to, contrary to what many of the bourgeois scholars say, up to late the end of 23, we'll say, to simplify, by and large, far from it being the case that the Comintern's policies were twisted to suit the national interests of Russian foreign policy, it was the other way round. My God. Of course, from the beginning,
There was always a certain dualism in this. Here you have an isolated worker state, and I will argue it continued to be a worker state until 28. You have an isolated, however deformed, what have you, an isolated worker state necessarily has to relate to the other state systems. They had concluded an agreement, a secret agreement, with the chiefs of the German army. Right, remember, Germany's the defeated power, supposed to be disarmed, and so on and so forth. They were manufacturing weapons for Germany, which the German army was not allowed to have under the Versailles Treaty. They set up training camps, military camps, German aviation. Germans weren't supposed to have any military aviation in Russia, defects and so on. And they had a close relationship. Right, these are people who supported the Cap Putsch, by the way. But don't be shocked, because at the same time, in the summer of 23, they were doing their damnedest to ensure the success of the revolution in Germany. They sent senior Russian military personnel to Germany, illegally, undercover and so on, to help to organize on the military side. They sent arms. Difficult problem, but they smuggled arms and so on and so forth. In terms of will, never mind that it was the whole operation was a fantastic cock-up, that's a question really of the political weakness of the German Communist Party, and to some extent even of the Russians. But in terms of political will, absolutely no question about it. The perspective is the destruction of the very Reichswehr that we are hand in glove with at another level. The dualism inherent from the beginning, the emphasis before the end of 23 on revolution. After 23, exactly the other way around. From that time on, although the process was a gradual one, it's not true, you go from white to black, a whole series of greys and muddled things in between, the Comintern increasingly became an instrument of Russian foreign policy. Now, I spent a lot of time, rather than going into the detailed events, which will come up in discussion, on explaining the Russian side of that. It didn't depend on the evil intentions of this or that person, not even Joseph Stalin. Right? It depended on the course, on circumstances and the course of events. But we have to ask another question, don't we? Come on. By that time, the French Communist Party, German Communist Party, Czech Communist Party, Polish Communist Party, Bulgarian Communist Party actually represented something. They actually operated. They didn't operate in the Kremlin or on Russian soil. They actually had a relationship with sections of their own working class. In the case of the Bulgarians, virtually the whole working class. And therefore you have to ask the question, yes, understanding the argument, you don't have to agree with it, understanding what was happening at the Russian centre, why do the troops, and not only the troops, but their generals, so to say, accept this? And that actually is not so simple either. The following things are important. First, success breeds success. Failure breeds failure. It's unfortunate, but it's a fact of life, because it means the vicious circle, or the virtuous circle, is hard to break. Well, we don't want to break the virtuous one, but it is a fact. The German party mucked it up at the time of the Cap Putsch. Mucked it up at the time of the March Act. They were passive abstentionists also left at the time of the Cap Putsch. They were adventurous, lunatic adventurism at the time of the March action. Right? When they should have been cautious. And then in 23, when they should have been adventurous, bloody, bold, resolute, no question about it, this is the time, this is the tide, and if we miss it, my God, you know? They learned the lessons of the March action, and they were too cautious. Right? Nevertheless, they were a big party still, but their confidence, their inner confidence was undermined. The inner confidence of the leadership in its own ability, and more important still, the confidence of the ranks in the ability of the leadership. Right? Similarly, although in not such a dramatic form, with the French, and so on. The Russians at least had made a revolution, you know, this is the mental process, and we mucked it up. And in Germany at least, you know, we had a series of chances, and we mucked it up. Therefore, defer to the wisdom of Moscow. That's the first thing. The second thing is, capitalising on that, what the Comintern leadership did in the immediate aftermath of the German defeat. Now here, we have to look at some, not technical, I have to give you some facts. The management at the Russell Centre formally hardly changed. The three Russians, there were 18 people on the Comintern executive, but the three who mattered from the beginning were the three Russian party representatives, Zinoviev, Bukharin, Radek. He was not really a Russian, but he counted as a Russian. He was a member of the Russian party. Radek was sacrificed after the German October. Zinoviev, Bukharin remained. They were in a block with Stalin. Stalin was not at that time in a position to run the show himself or to put in a nominee, an office boy. No, no. He needed still the process of the reaction, you know, proceeds gradually, a sort of cold counter revolution. He needed them. And they needed him. They drew the lesson. What happened? This is what they said to the parties. For the Fifth World Congress, 1924. They said, Germany, it was a disaster. What is the answer? They denied it was a disaster at first, by the way. They behaved like the militant tendency in the first years after the German defeat and said, you know, that everything on and on and on, up and up and up, irresistible revolutionary tide. It's obvious the bloody tide is going out fast. But, right, you can't keep that up for very long. After a certain time, they said, respectively, what was the root of the mistake? It was that the foreign parties are not modelled. Not really modelled on the true Russian pattern. 21 conditions for a dead letter, they say, which is true enough. Then 21 conditions serve their time, you know, serve their purpose. The whole point is Bolshevization. What does Bolshevization mean? It means organisational patterns, not of the Bolshevik Party of 1912, and still less of the Bolshevik Party of 1917, but of the bureaucratized party of 1924, a party which is run from the top downwards. That's the first thing. And it's plausible, comrades. You know, it's always worth asking ourselves, yes, I can see this is a piece of villainy. The question is, why do the suckers fall for it? You know, I mean, we've got big ones, the suckers. Why do people fall for it? You see, the appeal is strong, isn't it? After all, they are in power, and we've mucked it up, or we haven't had the opportunity yet. Therefore, we don't. But also it had a political component which was called Leninism. Now Leninism is an ideology. Leninism has produced in 1924, that's when they thought it up. Stalin gave these talks, someone else wrote them for him, but he delivered them competently enough. Lenin's Politics, Problems of Leninism, I don't know if people have read it. It's a beautiful, formal, boring, scholastic piece of work, if you look at it as a contribution to revolutionary theory, if you look at it as the founding text of an ideology, by which I'm using the term in strict Marxist sense, a false consciousness, a more or less systematic false consciousness, actually is the ideology of socialism in one country. Directed, of course, against the opposition, against Trotsky, by this time in opposition, in Russia, to serve Russian conditions. But all the Comintern parties were required, Fifth World Congress, to take up Bolshevization and the cult of Lenin, the cult of Leninism. And they were transformed. It was applied quite mechanically, incidentally, even, you know, in their own terms. I can't resist this little aside in terms of the British Communist Party. The British Communist Party was weak. But it was a real working class organisation, and it was coming into a period when it would have, events would have proved, real possibilities of large-scale influence. That's my case, anyway. People want to argue it otherwise. Doesn't matter. What happens to the Communist Party, specifically to its London district? I mean, we get this from the reminiscences of Red Groves and others, you know? They're actually there. First of all, we have, although we're not very strong in London, get rid of geographical branches. The basis of the party is in the factories. Look, I'll find you the appropriate quotation from Lenin. You know? Every factory must become our fortress, etc., etc., etc. But I haven't got very many people in too many workplaces. Never mind! It's done formally. Geographical branches are everyone's putting cells. Small cells. This group, that group. And since they're not in factories in many cases, they are oriented as Groves and Co. were on the railway system, round Patton Junction, what have you. That's one side of it. Second side of it, they've got to be active, they've got to sell papers. Good, all very fine. Away with all this discussion, this aimless and so on discussion that we've had in the party. The party is not a discussion circle, which is pretty true, and therefore split it into very small units, which are direct units. But there has to be an ideological component, doesn't there? So we have a whole structure, organisational structure above these groups. We have sub-regional committees, and then on top of the sub-regional committees, we have the London District Committee, full-timers, by the way. And then, of course, way up there, we have the mighty Central Committee, and the Central Committee is not a really operating body. Being good Bolsheviks, imitating the Russian pattern, ludicrously inappropriate, we have a Politburo, you know, on top of it. You know, the Russian party never had a Politburo until after the October Revolution. I mean, the whole thing is a nonsense in terms of the British party, whose membership at that time was smaller than ours is now, right? The London case, quote from Grose's reminiscences, the same round the country, even more of a caricature. But politically at the same time, the party members do in fact receive training. We have these aggregates at which the principles of Leninism, i.e. why Trotsky is wrong, why the left opposition has to be deposed, are put and expounded at great length, and everyone has to vote one way or another. Come on, they have to vote. So the British party, most of whose members knew absolutely damn all about the situation in Russia, well, that's not a criticism, it's a statement of fact, and certainly had no understanding at all of the issues at stake in the arguments about the German October, because though I said the left opposition started on the basis of palliatives for Russia, the centrally important thing for it in 1924 was the lessons of October. You know, the title of Trotsky's book, article. The whole problem of how a communist party reacts to the crises that will inevitably be produced in its own ranks and in its own leadership at the moment of a revolutionary situation. Why all that's wrong? Why Trotsky has to be condemned, and, you know, Stalin, all the rest of it proved. Now, that period of transition eliminated a considerable number of people, not so much from the ranks, but from the leaderships of the various parties. Of those people who were eliminated, many were unquestionably wrong politically. Many had a rightist orientation. Absolutely no question about it. Many had a leftist orientation, which may have been too leftist in some cases. The point is, the ones who were eliminated were the ones who were actually able to think, even if they weren't all very good thinkers, were actually able to think. They were not simply responding to whatever came out of the centre without thinking about it. That was done not by Stalin, but by Zinoviev, the dominant figure in the Comintern, 1924-25. The pattern was established. The leadership were turned over. They were not turned over by simple orders from Moscow. Again, I'm trying to convey to the comrades how it was possible for what was a genuine mass revolutionary organisation to be turned round. It wasn't done like that. Let's take the German example. The leadership of the German Communist Party was made the scapegoat for the October failure. They deserve a hell of a lot of the blame. I would say they deserve the greater part of the blame. But my God, they didn't deserve the whole of the blame. The Russians themselves, right, had taken much the same view. Right wing was made the scapegoat, and new left leaders were put in. Ultra left, actually. How was it done? Well, a Comintern rep, Bielski, was sent to do the job. Frankfurt Congress, my God. Sent to do the job. I don't know too much about this subject, I suppose. We're just beginning to develop it. Frankfurt Congress, party had just been re-legalised. All he had to do was appeal to the ranks. This was the situation. It was the great opportunity. And through criminal negligence on the part of the leadership, it was lost. And the ranks, the delegates, I mean, voted overwhelmingly in that sense. Of course, because there's an element of truth in it, large elements of truth in it, and vote to install the people that Moscow had decided ought to be installed. Now, see, bit by bit. Now, I have to speed this up, I'm afraid, but this transition period is absolutely central. After April 25, regime in Russia shifted power. Stalin broke with people like Zinoviev, Kamenev, 26 actually, but around this time. Because, fundamentally, you know what? They were a rotten lot in many ways. You know, Zinoviev had not only wavered at the time of the... Kamenev, too. I mean, Kamenev's case, you can't call it wavering. He had a consistently rightist orientation. Zinoviev, many times, not to left, wavered. And they attacked publicly the decision for the insurrection. My God. You know, Zinoviev's record in the whole Comintern period, the more you look at it, what absolutely scandalous weaknesses and so on. Same time, they had in the initial period taken a leading part in the anti-Trotsky campaign. Stalin couldn't have done it in the theoretical sense, he had the machine, but after all, Zinoviev, Lenin's closest colleague in exile, member of the party from 1903, member of the party from 1907, author of many articles, many speeches, not simply an apparatchik, not simply a machine man. Yeah, he was necessary to Stalin. Stalin broke with them, or they broke with Stalin, whichever way you put it, because they were no longer a suitable instrument for an increasingly nationalistic bureaucracy, an increasingly nationalistic one. In spite of all their weaknesses, they actually had too much of the original Bolshevik tradition of the early Comintern position. So they were shoved aside. Right, how was it done? The line of the parties has to be shifted rightwards. This happened in the period 1925-1928. The United Front is rediscovered. It had been junked in practice, not in words, but in practice in the period 1924-1925. Centrally important, here we have two disasters which I haven't time to talk about, but there's been talk on one anyway. Disastrous result of the right orientation in Britain. The British Communist Party had no possibility of seizing power. It did have the possibility of appearing, of coming out of the struggles of 1925-26 as a major rival of the Labour Party, as a major minority revolutionary party of the British working class. They mucked it up completely. And notwithstanding what certain clever people say about the weaknesses of the British CP leaders, which I don't doubt are true, the fact of the matter is they did so under pressure from Moscow. The Chinese Revolution, the event of a different order, world historic order, contrary to everything that had been said, talked about on the national question and so on before, the Chinese Communist Party, a fast-growing and influential organisation, the dominant organisation in terms of ideas of the Chinese working class, which was then quite big, became smaller later on, was subordinated to a bourgeois nationalist formation, and ultimately led like a sheep to the slaughter. Right? That's the result of the right turn. But I want to look at another aspect of the right turn, the same thing as the left. The turn in the line required a change of leadership. All Zinoviev's nominees, or, I exaggerate, in the important parties, Zinoviev's nominees were turfed out. Bukharin, Stalin still couldn't run the show himself. He now needed another, someone with a Bolshevik past and the ability to make a semblance of a plausible perspective analysis and so on. Bukharin's nominees were installed. Again, it wasn't so difficult, you see, but it wasn't simply at that stage the question of order. We'll come to a stage when it was. It was a question of saying the shift to the right, 1924 and so on, after in 1925, it was a question of saying, look, German CP is losing its influence in the workplaces. We had, 2 years ago, X delegates, I forget the exact number, at the Union Congress. How much a big organisation? Now we've got 100th part of X. This is the ultra-left stupidity of the leadership, fundamentally. Not wrong. Therefore, turf them out. But turning them out doesn't mean bringing back the people you turfed out before, because those people were, in different ways, people who've got a certain independence of mind. It means creating what they call leaders of a new type. Now, the essential characteristic of the leader of a new type was as follows. One, he must be a worker. Proletarian Party, he must be a worker. So, Telemann, docker, ex-docker. Tory in France, ex-coal miner. Actually, ex-colliery class, but they called him a coal miner. You know, and so on and so on. Britain, Harry Collins. Absolutely genuine time-served boilermaker, knowing no language but English. I don't say that to knock him, I don't either. You know, there's an essential characteristic, they must be workers. Secondly, they must be people of some energy, some talent, some ability as organisers, and preferably some experience of struggle. Thirdly, they must have no theoretical pretensions at all. That is to say, that in terms of policy, they learn to rely on not only what Moscow says, but by this time it's getting a bit more than that,
they must learn to read between the lines. You know, this is what he said, but what he's really meant. And since Harry Pollitt, to quote the British example, is quite incapable of doing this, we have to provide him, and ditto in Germany, France, and so on, with a smart intellectual without any intellectual integrity at all, who will interpret between the lines and say, Harry, I know it says that, but really, what does the text say? He will write the thesis to justify it. His name was Palm Duff in the British case, yeah? Similarly, Thalmann was provided with Lemley and all the rest of it. Now then, there was a qualitative degeneration in that period, the period of the right turn. The Colin turn became a centrist organisation. A centrist organisation with a rightward moving centrist. It was not an irrevocable write-off. It is the next stage where actually the swing left again. With the onset of the first five-year plan, break between Stalin and Bukharin, and in social terms, the determination of the bureaucracy to atomise the working class, to destroy the remaining rights of trade union organisations and so on, and at the same time expropriate the peasantry, the wealthy layer of the peasantry, the emergence of the totalitarian regime, the Comintern was ripped right round again to a wildly ultra-left position, characterised by the argument that the main, first of all, we're in a period of revolutionary upsurge. In this period of revolutionary upsurge, the main weapon of the ruling class is fascism, which incidentally would have been rubbish had they been true about the upsurge. Far from it being the case, fascism gained becomes a mass force, typically, in conditions when the working class is in retreat. But nevertheless, fascism is now the typical form of capitalist class rule, and the most important way in which it shows itself is through the social democratic parties and the corresponding trade union leadership. They are social fascists. Therefore, there can be no question the United Front with them. Of course, you appeal to their followers. You know, you talk about the United Front from below. The whole lunatic shift in that direction, I can't, mustn't fail to add that you will realise that the most dangerous form of social fascist is, of course, the left social fascist, the opponent within the Social Democratic Party, because he deceives people, you know, they think he's, etc., etc. Now then, look, I haven't time to elaborate these ideas. A discussion on the whole question of social fascism would be illuminating. The point is, in practice, it led to abstentionism. Abstentionism. Communist parties, wildly radical in words. You have no idea. There's a collection of documents in three volumes collected by a woman called de Graaf, who worked at one time in the Comintern Centre and then worked in a Cold War centre in the rest. But anyway, she's a competent translator. He read some of the stuff. Raving stuff from the third period, you know. How could they have swallowed this? And how could they swallow the shifts and turns within the third period? And the answer is, I think we have to say, actually, 1928, Sixth World Congress, the Comintern is a write-off as a revolutionary organisation. Trotsky took the contrary view, and I think I've no doubt he was right to take the contrary view at the time, you see what I mean, but he then subsequently proved it. The two successive turnovers of personnel, the nonsense, you know, the ritualistic Leninism, the forms of organisation which prevented the development of a real political cadre had killed it. Epilogue. It didn't matter to the Russians. They wanted no upheavals. During the stresses and strains of the five-year plan, we don't want any aggressive policy in Germany, we don't want any united front work, which may lead to big conflicts with the ruling class, perhaps the French intervention. God knows, we don't want anything like that. So, ultra-radicalism, practical abstentionism. Trade union work ceased to exist. Actually, we get ourselves thrown out of the union. Actually, we try and form pure red unions. Not always and everywhere. They were mealy-mouthed, equivocal, weasel-minded. You can find each side of the position quoted in their documents. As I say, you have to have the theoretician with his private line to Moscow to tell you what the current nuance really means. Yeah? It was proved in practice because in 1934, Hitler came to power at the beginning of 1933. Actually, the Russian leaders realised that they weren't going to be left alone. My God. Here is this man, in power, he smashed the German working class movement. By this stage, I didn't worry them. They ceased to be in any sense part of the working class movement. They have now become a self-conscious ruling class. But also, he's ripped up the Treaty of Versailles, he's proclaimed a great programme of rearmament, and he's going to attack Russia. My God, he even says so. Read Mein Kampf. Therefore,
we need allies. Not simply in the sense that they thought they needed allies between 25 and 28, you know, the bureaucracies of the Western labour movements, nationalist movements like the Kuomintang. We need people with power. Specifically, we need the French and German governments. Because given the military balance as it then was, Germany is still militarily vastly inferior to France and Britain, a military alliance, Russia, France, Britain, can crush him in short order. So, the change in line, the Popular Front. Now, the essence of the Popular Front line was this. Situation, this is what the manifesto said, no longer the same as in 1914. Internationalism now means you form blocs with all progressive forces, and progressive means anti-German. Basically, it means you form a bloc with anyone who, for whatever reason, Winston Churchill, right? Actually, for purely British nationalist reasons, right, from a very early stage, he sees Hitler is a menace. He's a menace to British imperialism, to the British Empire. Good, he's a progressive, therefore. You form blocs, you seek to pull the Social Democrats, and through them the Liberals and various levels of conservatives, into systematically classifying